be able to maximize the time. I'm a little bit conflicted because there are a lot of things that I would love to take advantage of this spot to discuss, and a lot of things that are going on the campus right now, some good, some more challenging, but a lot of things that are happening that are exciting and that could use everybody's complete involvement and even awareness of, and I am sorely tempted to monopolize the time and the minutes that we have now just to go through some of those things, but I want to be true to this spot of the staff training. And in general, the feedback that we've gotten for these staff trainings is that because it's so many people in and out and so many people's only opportunity, whether it's a guest from the outside or a Rebbe from the inside, so many people's only opportunity to address the group of staff, so they usually begin with the same type of introductory stuff and the same type of tangents, the same type of distractions. And then whatever the topic is at hand, they don't get to it all, or they get to it in the most general type of way without any types of specifics. So I am committed to not making that mistake. So therefore, what we're going to do is we're going to jump right into it, and we're going to try to be as practical as possible with a very, very interesting and important topic that was not chosen by me, but that I certainly embrace and I'm happy to address and to speak about with everybody. And I think it's an important one and a good one to speak about with everyone, especially at this point in the summer. And we'll try to time it in a way that in the last 7 or 8 minutes, instead of taking the beginning and letting it dominate the entire time, if we can get done what we have to get done the last 7 or 8 minutes, maybe we'll talk about a little bit in Yonah Dioma in terms of what's happening on the Kollel and what we can be working on together and what we can be doing and how we can be growing and making the program as successful as possible for as many people as possible, which is always a big idea of what we're doing. But I want to do full justice to the topic at hand. And like I said, I want to make it as practical as possible, and I certainly would love to have an opportunity for there to be questions also. The only point I'll make by introduction, and I think I've said it every time I've addressed this holy and esteemed group, and I'll mention it many more times when I do also, is just what a privilege it is to be able to sit and talk about such important things, specifically with each and every one of you. I know exactly how hard everybody is working, and I know how many implications there are of that idea of working hard. It's not just that people are putting in long hours and sweating a lot and schlepping a lot and really doing exhausting labor on behalf of the program, but people are working hard on improving and on growing and on making themselves better and on making the NCSYers better. And that's the heart and soul of what this program is. The dynamic and the energy of these staff trainings and the opportunity to be part of a chevra, of a growth-oriented society, this is obviously the theme of tonight's Leil Iyun, and so many of the reasons why we chose tonight's Leil Iyun and Rav Twersky's comments at the end of the night, I'm sure will reflect this as well. But just having a culture of working on improvement and bettering is a very, very special thing to be a part of. And I know few groups or individuals that are as capable and as talented and as committed to that as the group of people here right now. And just to be able to share some ideas and to be part of that movement and to be part of that energy is a big it's a big privilege for me, and it's a big excitement for me. It's a great thing and a great use of my time and a wonderful way to be able to spend a lunch here. So I appreciate your inviting me and allowing me to share a couple of words. So the topic we're speaking about is the one-on-one conversations, the role that they play in the work that we do, and how to do them in a more effective and a better way. And like I said, I'm going to leave much of the philosophy out of the discussion and try to be as practical as possible. Of course, we should point out, I think, as a starter and as an introduction, that we live in a world, and maybe this was always the case and they just figured this out 25, 30 years ago in the field of education, we live in a world of diversified education. Diversified education means that people have different learning styles and people have ways of engaging with any sort of growth-oriented process, whether it's learning or discussion-based, whether it's about just a life philosophy or whether it's about a one-on-one chavrusa that's learning a particular text or series of facts of information, people have different ways of learning. People respond to learning in different ways. There is a fascinating question that is not for now, that we won't speak about now. I don't want to be a tangent right now, but happens to be, I don't have a master's in education, but I did take some classes in Azrieli, and some of the best classes I took in Azrieli were about this very point, that to build up a successful school or program, and I remember those lessons very well, To build up a successful school or program, you need to build it on diversified education, diversified learning. The fact that there are learners who learn visually, learners who learn in groups, learners who learn in different ways. I remember when I was in Keren Biavne, just as an example of this also, and you all had this, I'm sure, in your yeshiva experiences. There were people who could not learn without shiur, and there were people who could not learn in shiur. And there are always going to be that type of situation in that. People who can learn in one way, but not another. I know Rashi Yeshiva today who could not function in the same shiur that they are giving right now. I was a classmate of theirs, and they just spent all day learning by themselves. I know other people, students, who are also Rosh Yeshiva right now, who to this day are really not capable of mastering learning completely by themselves, or learning b'chavrusa or the like. It's just a very big challenge for them to be able to do, and only in the unique dynamic of a classroom are they able to function and learn well. The interesting question that we're not going to speak about right now, we'll come back to that diversified learning and diversified education in a minute, but the interesting question that we have now is, what do you do when you encounter a person, especially at the age that we're dealing with our NCSYers, what do you do when you encounter a person who clearly is in that category? Let's take an obvious example, which doesn't come up so much in NCSY Kollel, but I'll be able to use it for illustrative purposes. You have a person who learns orally or visually, but not the other one. They can understand, you have this in math a lot of the times. They can do, there are people who can excel. They'll get a perfect score on their SATs as long as all the questions are word problems. Tell me about apples and give me a narrative and a story and put it into a paragraph. I can do any calculation in my head right away. As soon as you turn it into a number and an equation, I'm totally hopeless with it. And vice versa, you have that. So what do you do? And I remember having vociferous debates with some of my teachers in Azrieli about this exact point. We acknowledge that that exists. We acknowledge that that's a reality. We're not babying anybody. This 12-year-old math student, this 6th grader math student can deal with any type of it. If you put it on the board and you place it in front of him and he can learn visually, he's great. If you're describing it orally, he can't do it at all. He can't follow the oral. He can only learn with his eyes. He can't learn with his ears. We'll come back to that point probably later on when we get to our main idea. What do you do with that 6th grader? So the conventional wisdom then, and I actually think it's still the conventional wisdom until today, is that you teach Chanocha Naro Pidarko, you teach that 6th grader in exactly the way he's most likely to learn in the best possible way. You teach that 6th grader in the way you're going to give him the opportunity to succeed as best as possible. I argued at the time, and I still believe, aren't you, especially with a 12-year-old and a 6th grader, and it's not so different for a 16-year-old you have in your chabura, aren't you handicapping him as well? If you do not devote any of your time, and you just acknowledge at the age of 12, he will never learn visually, instead of acknowledging that maybe we have the ability to take him from a 10% learner visually to a 25%, which could be a life and death type of career success, getting into a good college. And as I don't know if you want to buy in completely to only cater to the strength, cater to the weaknesses. I remember actually, and I've described this to you before, when I was deciding and choosing a yeshiva, so the most interesting question, overall question that I had, is do you look for a yeshiva post-high school that caters to your strength or caters to your weakness? If you have a yeshiva, and I had this conversation not long ago actually on NCSY Kollel with Rav Tursky. Rav Tursky was observing how many people do not take to a particular style of learning and their own learning as madrichim on NCSY Kollel. And again, I don't know if he would want me to reveal this at all, but it's what he said to me, observed to me, and I drew it out of him. And he said to me, there's just a lot of people who are second, third year based medrash, they have a style of learning, and if they're not their style of learning, they're not going to do it. And they're not going to follow it at all. And I reminded him, and I described to him my experiences in Moresh HaKollel, where everything you did in the summer, this is an entire philosophy for Bein HaZmanim, which is a different discussion, not for right now. Entire philosophy is you use those off period times, you use those Bein HaZmanim, you use Moresh HaKollel or NCSY Kollel specifically to work on your area of weakness. There have to be times where you say, okay, I'm going to cater to my strength. You go to yeshiva, imagine a 12th grader, and we'll be speaking to 12th graders tonight as part of the Leliyun. Some of you will be speaking to them directly about how to choose a yeshiva and about how to maximize their learning time in the 12th grade. Maybe we won't do the choosing yeshiva part tonight. That might be later in the summer. But what do you tell them exactly? They hear a yeshiva that's right up their alley. I would argue you're doing an injustice to them. You're doing something that's not the greatest way to learn. Why do you want to be in a place that's right up your alley all the time at the ripe age of 17 where you've defined yourself such a narrow set of circumstances by which you're going to be successful? Okay, that's just a side point and a little bit of a thought question that I think is relevant to a lot of these things and we have to consider. But No one would argue that diversified education exists, and I want everybody to observe how well and how carefully we employ that strategy and how everybody has to take advantage of that strategy on NCSY Colo. People learn a good number of hours. For some of the NCSYers, it's more hours right now than they might be used to or might even be able to bear right now, and that's okay. But no two of those hours really are the same. I'm exaggerating when I say no two of those hours are the same. Some of those hours are the same, but most of those hours are different. Chaburas are not the same as morning shir, and night chavrusas are not the same as chaburas, and night shir is a different animal altogether as well. There is a very different learning dynamic, and that is very much by design. There's a very different learning dynamic throughout the day. It's to keep things fresh and interesting, but it's equally there so that people who learn in different ways can maximize their learning opportunities in those ways. There are people who will learn the most in a formal classroom like this one, post-11th grade with Rabbi Savolovsky in this very room, around these very tables on a daily basis. And there are people who are really not capable of learning in that way, and therefore we need to provide them with other opportunities for learning and for growth. And some of those opportunities for learning and growth extend outside of the classroom and outside of the base medrash, and they involve the type of one-on-one conversations that may take place in a chavrusa at night, but are more likely to take place on a bus, on a tiyul, around the campus, taking a walk, late night before curfew, or at any other time like that. And that it is a critical, critical dimension of what we are trying to do in the chinuch we're trying to provide. The more of those conversations that we have with the more people, the more effective that we are going to be. And the more we're going to be able to accomplish the goals that we have, and that's probably going to be what we bring out in the third of 3 points that I want to try to make right now about what makes these conversations so unique. That'll be the third point. But what also the opportunities to present, like I said, that's in the third point, but the first 2 points about how to do them most effectively. What is unique other than the number of people involved? So, okay, the biggest difference between a chabura and a one-on-one conversation is the number of people involved. One of them has 5 or 6, and one of them has only 2 people involved with it. But obviously it goes far beyond that, as everybody here is surely aware of, and we need to identify what are the pieces of the dynamic that are accessible to us, and therefore what are the ways that we make those conversations most effective, most productive, and most enjoyable, really, for the NCSYers that are there. So I will start with something which might be less obvious, and it's probably the most important of the 3 points we're going to make right now, not completely independent of the fact that it is an obvious point that to be there. And it's a point that I try to make as often as possible, even in the context of chaburas, but I think it has its greatest application in the context of a one-on-one conversation. A one-on-one conversation, even in contrast to the most interactive and the most back and forth type of chabura that you might have, a one-on-one conversation is a conversation. And a conversation has 2 parts. The most important skill for a successful one-on-one conversation, and this is not radically different than the answer to the question of what's the most important skill for just being a good madrich, rebbe, or friend in general, is to be able to use one's ears instead of one's mouth. To be able to master the art of being a listener. We have a lot of good speakers on this program. We have a lot of good speakers and teachers in this room. There are people who have at a very young age, I'm not talking about our phenomenal Rebbe staff or the Rashi Yeshiva, I'm talking about us in this room right now. There are people who at a very young age have mastered the art of teaching to an astounding degree. To walk around the chaburas with Rabbi Weil, or to have Rabbi Kamenetsky get off a plane last week and do a quick review of the chaburas, he's blown away. I'm sure he's communicated that to many of you. He's walking around and saying, I mean, this is just an extraordinarily high level of teaching, and I will paraphrase that and say it's an extraordinary high level of talking. But how many people in this room, how many people on this program, how many staff members, and here I include our phenomenal Rebbe staff, the administration of the program, I'm certainly guilty of this myself, and it's something which I embrace this opportunity to be with you today so that I can recommit myself to being this way, not only for the 280 participants at NCSY Kollel, but for my children, and for my spouse, and for my own personal friends also. I know that I'm a halfway decent speaker. I don't know and need to work on to be a better person, a better Jew, and a better mechanech if I am a good enough listener. Do I know the art of listening, and do I know the art of letting another person speak and to talk, responding and hearing what they are saying? I can tell you with certainty, and I don't have to beat myself up to do it, but including our administration and Rabbeim, some of the most accomplished teachers anywhere, including them in this massive group of people of over 100, I don't know how many exceptional listeners we have. I know we have a few. I'm agnostic about a whole bunch of others because I haven't experienced it with them. But I know we don't have 78 of them. I know we're not in the upper reaches of, you know, the double digits in evaluating how many great listeners we have. And if we're going to be good at one-on-one conversations, which is small potatoes, but if we're going to be good at one-on-one conversations, and if we're going to be great as madrichim, as staff members, as Rebbeim, as influencers, we have to learn the art of listening. And as a side benefit, it's going to make us better parents, husbands, children to our parents all the time as well, because it's a skill that's a life skill, and it's an incredibly, incredibly valuable life skill to have. Very often we don't even know what it means to be a good listener. There's a fascinating description that is found in a number of places about the different words that are used biblically to describe silence. There is a cheresh, which is a deaf mute. There is shtika, which is, of course, a common word in modern Hebrew and in biblical Hebrew to denote silence. And then we have what seems to be a different level of silence found specifically in Aaron HaKohen's reaction to the death of his sons, the most famous pasuk quoted at any funeral all the time, Vayidom Aaron. Vayidom Aaron is being dumbstruck. Vayidom Aaron is a sense of complete and total speechlessness. Many times when we are not speaking and quote-unquote listening, what we are really doing is taking a breath in conversation and calling a timeout. I am being polite and giving my partner, whether it's my wife or my child, my chavrusa or my NCSYer, I am giving them an opportunity to speak before I take my turn to then speak at the same time. I think I've given the analogy before, probably in this context, although maybe in a different one. The way that Westbrook and Durant played basketball, for example, was not teamwork. They took turns and deferred to each other in one-on-one basketball. That's right. And Curry and Durant are not much different, quite honestly, in the way Golden State ran their beautiful offense pre-Durant and the way they run it now. I'm not sure there's anyone to blame with this, and we don't have the time to analyze basketball right now, but understand its application to the way in which we interact with people. There's taking turns talking, and then there's listening. Then there's a real dialogue that's going to be there. As much as I've stressed and said, and as much as I've meant the fact that this is a general issue that applies to our marriages and to our relationships, to our friendships, and to the way we are with our children, with our parents, make no mistake about it that this is a specific challenge for us here on NCSY Colo. Because there is almost a disease, and certainly a pitfall that we can acknowledge, where we really feel it is important that we talk a lot. There is a pressure that we feel to be able to have all of the answers and to be able to provide all of the insights in every single situation. And I have said, and I am remiss if I don't say it once a week to the staff of the Kollel, the most important words that you know as a madrich, as an advisor, are, I don't know. The most important tool you have are our ears to be able to not talk and to listen and to respond and to really understand the people that we are speaking to, and to give into that pressure all the time of having all of the answers and being able to provide all the solutions, there's a great danger in that. That's not the way things are supposed to be, and it makes us worse as influencers almost completely invariably. Since we're speaking a little bit practically, and I've already brought in the way we are with marriages all the time, probably I would speculate that it might be the most important piece of kind of marital psychology advice that I've ever seen in my life. The best-selling book, probably of all time, is the famous Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus, a book by John Gray, who is one of the two or three leading marriage psychologist experts. Not a Jew, and it's not a sefer, although a great number of rabbanim recommended to chassanim and kallahs before their wedding to be able to read. And I'm in that group. I think it is a good book to read. I think it has insights in it. But its number one insight, the title of the book gives away a lot of it, is that how men and women are different and that we have to respond to each other in different ways. It's very frum in that respect, about not having complete equality and not believing that men and women are exactly the same, just in different bodies. But the most interesting insight, which again, on an introspective level, as a person, or any of us who try to be students of Musar and try to have self-improvement and the like, is about the tendencies and mentalities of males in general, specifically in the context of a marriage relationship, and this absolutely applies to every chavura. When a woman tells her husband, when a woman tells her boyfriend about a problem, going back to evolutionary times and going back to cavemen and going back to the men as the hunter and the men as the conqueror, the man hears that and his desire is to solve the problem. Or to take it personally that if you have a problem, by definition, that problem is with me. My job is to provide for you and make you happy. And therefore, if you come home, my wife comes home and says she has a hard day, I am programmed. It is in my DNA that my reaction is one of two things or a combination of those two things. Either what did I do wrong to create this? What's wrong with me that you are not the happiest person in the world 24/7, 365 days a year? Or my reaction is, okay, what can I do to fix this? Neither of those things are a healthy reaction. Nobody came to me because I was supposed to have all the answers. And understand the thinly veiled analogy that we're saying here as it relates to a chabura also. When you're in a one-on-one conversation, we have a unique opportunity. It is not possible, and I'm on record for saying it all the time, our ears are not our most valuable weapon in chabura. We can't have anybody but ourselves dominate the floor and dominate the room. What am I doing right now? It is entirely possible that we will run out of time long before we get to questions. It could be that from 12:39 until 1:19, the only voice that's heard in this room is mine. I won't say that that's a mistake. Could we have a more interactive session? Could we take the 70 people in this room and get more feedback and maybe have something more lively and end up closer to the truth with a great deal of crowdsourcing and getting different ideas and voices? Sure. But I would argue that in a certain situation, in your chaburas this afternoon, if the only voice that's heard with yours, that might be very appropriate. Again, chaburas are not quite a shir, and you don't have 70 people in a chabura, so chaburas are always going to be somewhere in the middle. I think that's muvan mei lav in what we're saying. That's probably self-evident that chaburas are not quite the opposite extreme of a one-on-one conversation. They have many dimensions of a one-on-one conversation, and I hope we get to that explicitly in a couple of minutes. But it's entirely possible that you'll give the best chabur you've given all summer, and for those 50 minutes, the only voice is heard that's yours. If that happens in a conversation, it is an utter and complete failure, without exception. They're not coming to hear what you have to say. They are coming to you to be heard. And the best way to guide them and advise them is by listening carefully and sensitively to what they're saying. And don't think that that's accomplished just by being quiet. That goes to, like I said before, what Chazal explained about the different languages of shtika. There's shtika that is, and we're going to speak about this in our morning mentoring chabura also, in the context of Shmiras HaLashon, and it's also such a vital and important point. There's shtika where the words are bubbling up and they're just waiting for their turn to be said, and there's shtika of, I don't know what to say yet because I haven't listened enough. Vayidom Aaron meant that Aaron had nothing to say, and that Aaron was observing, taking in, responding, coping, dealing with the reality around him before he was running to say something. An effective conversation is a conversation. An effective conversation involves listening and sensitivity. The great examples of this are in the most phenomenal poskim, and again, I think I quoted this to a group of people not long ago, but the entire, you know, they have it in a whole bunch of people about the question about Dalit Kosos on milk, and the response being about it. Dalit, I think I spoke about this in one of the other sessions, non-hour specific sessions in Connecticut. I don't remember exactly. But, you know, about the Dalit Kosos on milk, and hearing from that the woman didn't have money for meat, and responding to that shaila by giving the woman tzedakah money instead of answering her question about whether you could be a yotzi dalit kosos on milk. And I saw, just even on a simple level, a beautiful example. There was a world-class posek in Israeli publications, is a growing part, it's a beautiful thing actually, and datilumi circles here, it's called Shoot SMS, shelos and tshuvos that people fire off to various rabbanim, Rav Avinair in particular. He gets upwards, I've heard different numbers of 5,000 to 10,000 shilos a week that are going over SMS, over cell phones, that people are shooting at him, and halacha and machshav and all sorts of different things. So I was so unbelievably moved by it. He was asked a very intricate question about refuah, about a person in a hospital. I don't remember if it had to do with Chilul Shabbos or if it had to do with quality of life or the end of it. And Rav Avinair was asked a very, very complex question about refuah, about life in a hospital and the rest of it. What was Rav Avinair's answer to the question? Refuah Shalema. That was his answer to the question, first and foremost. It's not a piece of paper. It's not waiting for my fountain of information to be spilled out and given over to you. That's our mentality in so many of these conversations. Okay, here's another platform for me to give over everything I have in the world. Our first instinct is not to listen first. Our first instinct is not to respond to what's actually being said. Think about how many times we're doing that take turns mentality when we're having these types of conversations. I know exactly what I'm going to say. I'm just waiting for the right time to say it. It's the wrong way to have a conversation. First and foremost, to listen, to be able to say, I hear what you're saying, to empathize, to feel pain, and we're uniquely situated to do that in one-on-one conversation. And accept it upon ourselves. We should have a tarvis dibur when we go into a one-on-one conversation. You know, the same way you might have a 5-pass rule before you take a shot, or the same way you might limit your minutes if you're the top player on your team. We need to do that in one-on-one conversations. I'm going to monitor. You know, there's an old thing about dating that people say is, you know, they just pay attention. They want to know the midos and the character of a person, so you just analyze the number of I's in a conversation. You analyze the number of times in a conversation the person says I. The one you want to marry is the one who says you at a ratio of 3-1 to their I's. That happens not to be a I don't know if you should sit there with a pen and paper and start calculating like that. It's not a terrible litmus test of a person's character. We all know people who are full of I's instead of you's. There is a corollary to that. We also know people who are full of talking instead of listening. So monitor and ask ourselves and take ourselves up Tanis Dibor. I'm going for a walk with an NCSYer and I am going to say one word for every one of his 10 or else I'm not doing my job. And if he's not ready to talk to me, we'll get to that in a second. That's our second point. If he's not ready to talk to me, then maybe I'm not ready for a one-on-one conversation. Because a one-on-one conversation is not a mini shir or a mini chabura. And even a mini shir or mini chabura, we probably talk and say more things than we should and don't give enough opportunity to really listen and to pay attention to where the NCSYers are and what they're doing. I heard really a beautiful analogy, and I shared this with some of the NCSYers in the night shear about their own level of self-awareness and its importance. I was makabel upon myself. I almost had to do Ataris Nadarim in order to give such an analogy because, you know, I don't like the cliches and Rabbeim who give analogies on GPS and on Waze and the rest of it as being, you know, find your destination and have all of that. So I was makabel myself never to use such analogies again. Yes, we get it. There are similarities to the Avoda of Musar and finding your directions to get to the closest Starbucks, you know, in a foreign city. We understand it. And we understand that the voices, you know, that go on, there are a lot of analogies there. But I heard just recently an analogy that I had not heard before. And it's an amazing, I just think it's incredibly powerful and beautiful. Because of bad Wi-Fi and because of the nature of technology and the nature of communication and the like, before you reach any destination, you get that little circle in Waze where they try to figure out where you are. That's an amazing, amazing moment of Musar. It's an amazing moment of Musar. Before you get the detailed step-by-step directions of getting somewhere, it takes a minute or two to figure out where you are. It takes a minute or two to figure out who you're talking to. And I challenged the NCSYers with that. I said to them on the very first night share that I gave them, which was 10 days ago, going back to the beginning of last week at the beginning of the journey, it was a bunch of guys, second-year guys, motivated guys. Don't just run like a chicken without your head. First, figure out who you are, where you are, what you're doing, what any of this means to you, what you're going to try to accomplish. You can't jump into the directions. You can't jump into the journey and just go headlong into it because it's not going to work. But that same thing could be flipped around to a one-on-one conversation. You got to get that circle going first. You can't give hadracha, we can't give advice or direction unless we first take those few minutes or seconds of let me just get a sense of where we are. Let me listen and empathize to the person who's in pain. Let me try to figure out what their issues are and what they need to hear, not what I prepared in May. Chaburas, give over what you prepared in May to be able to say within reason, within a certain measure. But in a one-on-one conversation, how do you come in with scripted remarks? Bill Walsh scripted the first 15 plays for everything like that. It's the wrong way to have a one-on-one conversation. It's the right way to have a chabura, by the way. I script to this day, my first day of shir, I can tell you every single word I'm going to say before I go in. Because it's not a time to listen, and I have to have the script, and I'm going to do it, and then you get into a rhythm a little bit, and then you figure it out a little bit. And in many chaburas, even later on in the summer, that's not a bad idea. But in a conversation, if you're going in with an agenda and a script, we're definitely doing something wrong. What do you do? Point number two. How do you make these conversations more effective? So there is an art form of being evocative. There is an art form that is particularly challenging, but doable. It makes it more of an art form in the art of conversation with high school boys and teenage boys in particular. teenage boys, especially in the era of technology, and it was always like this to some extent, to a great extent. We all were teenage boys. We all remember what it is to be like that. Not exactly the best conversationalist of all time. There is an art form to get people to think and to get people to talk. Raise your hand. You don't actually have to raise your hand, but think to yourself, if you're a madrich who made a call in June to a group of high school guys that you did not know, tell me how many of those conversations were free-flowing and productive. How many of those conversations were not challenging and awkward? They are, by definition, challenging and awkward. There is nothing to say and nothing to speak about right at that point. And that can continue for many, many weeks in the summer. There is a real art form of leading questions that need to be said. We go and we fall back on scripts, once again, and cliches and conversations that are not effective at all. How's it going is not an evocative question. How's it going is not going to elicit response. It's going to kill the conversation there. We had a guy in one of my shiurim in Reshit a number of years ago, a delightful, delightful guy, and a wonderful, wonderful Talmud. He had an artistic talent that was in the exact opposite direction. His nickname was Conversation Killer. He had an uncanny ability to destroy any conversation with the comments that he made all the time. There was just no possible response to anything he ever said. You'd have this great momentum and this great conversation, whether it was learning or something else, and he would open his mouth and we would all just be like, there's no response to anything you ever say. You kill every conversation. The flip side is doable also. There are ways in which we could surprise ourselves and surprise our NCSYers in the way we give over to them and the way we have conversations with them. Leading conversations can be, again, sometimes specificity helps in a great deal. If you are speaking to a teenage child later on in your lives, you'll have this opportunity. How was your day or how's it going is worthless. What was the best part of your day? And again, some of these are a little bit corny and they're not going to work all the time, but there's a world of difference between a specific question and a non-specific question. Questions that interest them matter a lot more than questions that interest us. Questions that make them think are fodder for good conversations that are there. Sometimes some rabbeim I know who are very, very good at the art of conversation, they have a stable of these types of questions that they ask that they're ready to go for the time when it might come with a long walk. Tell me who the five greatest role models on your life is. Tell me what the happiest day of your life was. And that's just why you're not having the great time here. What does make you happy? Or, again, even more specific, what was the happiest day of your life? What was the best summer experience you ever had and why? Those are evocative types of questions that get conversations going to a much greater extent than how's it going. Much greater extent than something generic that they're able to deflect. If you can predict the answer with ease, then it's probably not the right question. If you know how you would respond or anyone was going to respond, if you can guess in advance that the answer to a leading question is going to be a shrug of the shoulders or something like that, then it's probably not going to be an ideal type of question. There is a studious type of art form, meaning something that we can learn and understand about how to ask and engage in leading questions. Never prying questions. Leading questions are not prying questions. You're not going for personal information. That's a big no-no in one-on-one conversations also. You're not that guy and we're not entitled to that information. But to be able to ask leading questions, to be able to give over questions that are going to A, make the NCSYer think, and B, provide further ground for further conversation, and be able for us to respond in turn to what they say and learn something from the conversation. Ask questions that you're genuinely curious about. I want to know what you think about or how you find a certain thing or a certain part of the program. I don't know Rabbi Bomzer at all. I'd love your feedback on Rabbi Bomzer. I'm genuinely curious about what style of shiur does Rabbi Bomzer give. That's a really good question to give and not an inappropriate one. And how are you relating to that particular style? Again, specificity helps a lot. Curiosity helps a lot, and understanding what they're interested helps a lot, but the goal remains the same. There are a lot of ways to skin that cat. There are a lot of ways to accomplish it, but you want something that's not a conversation killer. You want something that is evocative to a significant degree, something that is going to lead to further conversation, something that's going to make a person think, and there is an art form for that. There are, you know, playing a game and having it in your mind all the time, the same five questions with. PTI does it, and a whole bunch of other shows do it. 5 good minutes with. The same questions that you ask all the time, and you have them there, and you try to understand them a little bit. It's good to intersperse those questions between the kal and the kaved. It's not good if all of those questions are life and death questions, and the most important moment of your life, or the best role model that you ever had. You want to make them a little bit silly also. You want to talk about food, and you want to talk about bowl, you want to talk about weather, you want to talk about things that just generate conversation, dialogue, and discussion, not questions or statements that end the conversation right there. Any questions, anything you want to talk about, those are worthless because they don't make a person think, they just make a person want to end the conversation and get out of there. Those are all examples of conversation killers. They don't work at all, and we use them all of the time. When I have one-on-one interactions, I am well aware of how worthless most of those interactions are. I neither have the time nor the patience to have meaningful one-on-one conversations with all that many people. So passing a person on the way to the game and asking how's it going doesn't qualify as a meaningful one-on-one conversation. Unless we have a list of an understanding, not of statements, as we said before, but of questions that we ask in these types of scenarios, opportunities that we have that will really do it. A second-year guy, how does the second year compare to the first? Get thought questions. How does the second year compare to the first year? Better or worse than that? Rapid fire is very good like that also. I got six questions for you. I want one-word answers. Again, that works better in Chabura than it does, and as we spoke about in Connecticut, works better in Chabura than it does in a one-on-one conversation. You don't want to over-gimmick or game a one-on-one conversation. You want it to be more natural and organic and authentic as a conversation. But rapid fire helps a lot also. Just give me a one-word answer to this. If you had to say in one word what you thought about this, again, that's thought-provoking. Even though that doesn't generate conversation in the sense that it's limited to a single word, but it's still valuable in terms of doing that. So that would be point number two. Point number three, which is really a summary of the first two points and really brings us to what I was hoping we were going to have time for. I'll say it as quickly as I can to be able to do, which is a little bit of where we're holding right now. One-on-one conversations are a unique opportunity. This is no contradiction to point number one. It's actually a summary of point number one. But when you get to the point of understanding and sensitivity that you can only get to from a one-on-one conversation, one-on-one conversations are an opportunity to say something that is directed, focused, and meaningful. The best public speakers in the world, the best Bali Musar in the world, will speak to an audience of 400, and they will get to the point where every one of those 400 people said, I remember people for years and years saying this about Rav Blachman on Motzei Shabbos in his house, when he would have dozens of people crowded in his living room, many of whom he had never met in his life, and they would say, he's not a good Rebbe, he's not a good teacher, he's a prophet. He's doing mind games. How did he know exactly what my issue was? How was he speaking so directly to me? So that's a superior educator and intellect who knew the tricks of how to do that. We all too often are in the opposite direction. The opposite and converse of that, and there's nothing facetious about it. I'm not making jokes or making fun of the conversation killer here. When I say this, the absolute opposite from which we can see what the objective is I'm having a one-on-one conversation and I don't think he's actually talking to me. He's not saying anything to me that I need to hear or that demonstrates any degree of understanding of where I am in life and what my challenge is right now. There is a way and an opportunity in a one-on-one conversation to give over directed, focused, strong messages and ideas. To figure out, after the listening process, what is it that this partner, what is it that this person, what is it that this NCSYer has to hear from me right now. We do not message enough. We do not process enough on things in this program. We do not explain enough, we do not give over to enough, and for the purposes of today's conversation, we don't speak directly enough on the program. And again, there's something sequential here, not contradictory. Contradictory would be speak and listen at the same time. It's impossible. Sequential means listen first and then make sure before that conversation ends or at the very beginning of the next conversation, you come up with the message and the idea and you're not afraid to speak directly. You're not afraid to call a bluff. You're not afraid to explain. You're not afraid, as we spoke about both in Connecticut and Ramat Beit Shemesh, you're not afraid to make the case case for what we're doing over here. There were people who were inspired and engaged by this morning's program and people who were more distant from it. Explain it to them on their level why it mattered and why it was so extraordinarily special. We've asked Madri Chaim and other staff members to go over the schedule of the Leil Iyun. Explain it to them why, for where they are right now, that this Leil Iyun is speaking to them and why you are speaking to them when you describe the Leil Iyun. People who feel disconnected from the program in general, make the case for them why they belong here and why this program is speaking to them. Be the conduit of the directness of that message and take advantage of the one-on-one. You need to be Rav Blachman to be able to do that to 500 people. You need to be Josh Fagan in order to do that to 6 people. But every one of us can do it with one person if we're connected to it. Every one of us can have that type of one-on-one relationship where, based on the fact that we're listening, we then have the confidence to give a directed, specific message of what they need to hear right then. If we're speaking in generalities, this is the common point between all the points that we're making. If we're just giving platitudes and cliches, and we're just saying the shava l'chol nefesh type of Torah and insights, okay, so that's what we did. We had a very, very small shiur with an audience of one. That's not the worst thing in the world. You can make birchas haTorah on that. But it's not what we can take advantage of when we have a one-on-one type of interaction where the opportunities are so much greater. And those opportunities, again, to be clear, are opportunities to listen, to understand, to work on our sensitivity, and to work on the fact that we're speaking to a real person with real feelings, with real emotions, and to be not just great teachers, but the great listeners. Number two, to be able to move a conversation forward by learning the art of conversation and how to be more evocative and to give forethought to the types of questions for this NCS Wire that are going to get a response, a silly response, an insignificant response, or maybe a life-changing response, but at least a response. And number three, to take advantage of the opportunity to give over directed messages that make the NCS Wire feel, for the first time in my life, I feel like someone was speaking to me, someone was talking to me, and it's so much easier to do that on a one-on-one than it is on any other scenario. Never force, never make it fake, never pry, never be inappropriate in a one-on-one conversation, which obviously are more susceptible to those types of emotional overloads that are not appropriate. But do these three things, and again, I think it's a leg up and a successful way to have one-on-one conversations that, as we said at the outset, are such a vital, vital part of what we're trying to give over, and one of the many ways in which we're trying to be mechanic and to inspire the NCS Wires that are here. Thank you very much for all that you are doing. I really, really appreciate it. I'd love to be able to talk about some of the things that are going on, and maybe we'll find the opportunity to do that, you know, for 5-10 minutes in one of the morning meetings in the coming days before our big Shabbos and Tisha B'Av coming up. I think that would be an appropriate and good thing to do, and I look forward to following up with all of you. Shkoyach. Bench and head up to Mincha.